Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. Today, our guest is the one, the only, Graham Binks. He has a new book called Trusting Technology. We're going to talk about it today, especially when we talk about the challenges in HR regarding technology. All you HR folk out there, business leaders, when you think about technology, please do not sigh during this conversation. We're going to tell you it's okay. Right, Graham? That's what we're going to tell them. It's okay.
100%, Dave, 100%.
All right, because I know. I talk to HR leaders all the time. And when you say technology, they either sigh or they think of their, you know, HRAS system, or they think of how technology and the phones and how they're dealing with the challenges of technology, right, in the workplace. I mean, this is the reality of it, right, as they're dealing with it from an HR perspective. But are HR leaders concerned enough about technology in general, or is all that concern warranted, I guess, is the best way to put it?
Yeah, I think it is, and I'll tell you how I look at it, Dave. So I think it's more than a truism to say that every business relies on technology today. And also, we all know from our business lives or our personal lives that the potential of technology is constantly accelerating. You know, it feels particularly like the last decade, like it's kind of overtaken a lot of our private lives as well. When you couple that with the fact that no business can afford to stand still, I think technology is a vital issue for all business leaders. And there's a particular role that I think HR leaders have. But let me step back. I look at it as technology is a tool. We all use tools in our private lives and in our work, and we're talking about business today. I get comfortable with the tools I use. If the business changes those tools, hopefully for the better, it's going to put me through a little bit of distress just because it's going to change my daily routine. I have to readjust. I believe, and I think a lot of people believe, that change is good, but it's the transition that's really difficult. And that's really, I think, a key touch point for HR leaders, because it's not about the technology. It's about what the technology can do for us and to us. And there's a lot of human factors associated with that. And I think that's the opportunity for HR.
You know, technology is a blessing and a curse, right? And if you talk to HR professionals or you talk to business owners, C-suite executives, they'll tell you it's a necessary evil, right? And it has made amazing strides in making life and work better. Certainly the evolution of AI that's coming in now, and we certainly had a guest on a couple months ago talking about some of the amazing things coming forward. But it does cause a trust factor. There is this element of this, and there is a generational nature of this, by the way, too. No question about that. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, this trusting of technology or this lack of trust of technology and how we have to deal with it.
Yeah. So I think whenever we ask somebody or something to do a job for us, we're essentially delegating that responsibility. We can do it ourselves, but we can't do everything. So we have staff to do work for us. We're delegating responsibility to them. We have machines to do work for us. So that's a big leap, especially for folks who are early in their career. So to trust people or equipment or machines to do things for them, you've got to have some level of confidence that it's going to work well. You've probably got to learn some of that confidence over time, and we try a little bit more until we're comfortable that it works. If I'm a business owner and I'm trusting the operations of my business to a computer system, or if I'm trusting the efficiency of my call center and the first responders to my customers to a business system, that's a huge leap of faith. In our private lives, we ask technology to send our information, our emails, securely, so that it goes to the people we intend it to and not to someone who doesn't, to calculate our financial investments and the value of what we should do, just to take care of our important life information. So there is a big element of trust there. I believe that trust is hard won and it's easily lost. So if something breaks once, it's going to be a lot harder for me to trust it in the future. I need to understand why it broke and what we can do about it. I will say, though, that technology isn't smart enough to make mistakes. It only does exactly as we or someone else told it to do. So the trust really is via the technology to the people that we partner with who built that technology. It's multifaceted, but I think the more any of us can understand about how stuff works, the more likely we are to feel confident that it's going to work for us.
When we're talking about trusting technology, I think one of the super elements of trust is belief that it helps us. I think there's an element, and I think of phones, if you use that as a technology example, right? Because it's so prevalent today. This trust factor in, is it giving us the right answer? Is it really saving us time? Is it saving us as much as we think it is? How do you address that?
It's kind of interesting. Every time I start to use a new tool, I feel like it's taking me longer, whether it is or not. But over time, I kind of don't notice when it gets faster than it used to be. But if we were all to wind the clock back 10 years and think about how we communicated with each other, how we watched television, for example, how we got our news, and we look at how much more of that there is now, that speaks to the efficiency. Now, you can argue there's too much information today, and I believe that the next boundary here is to help curate information so we get what we need. But nonetheless, I think if we look back in time and compare it to today, we'll probably be better positioned to notice how it's improved our lives, as well as how it hasn't. But I think on balance, I'm a great believer that technology does improve lives, but it takes time.
So your book, in terms of the, you know, this conversation really that you're having about trusting technology, mastering technology for non-tech leaders, tell me a little about where you came up with this concept, you know, why you wrote the book. Tell me a little about the history behind it.
Sure, yeah. So I think my passion is really for making things work better. I have a curiosity, you know, you give me a new phone or a new toy, I'm going to try and figure out how it works and then how it could work better. In my career of 30 years, technology has been the best way I've found to have an impact with that curiosity. Now, despite how much we all rely on technology, according to the U.S. Labor Bureau statistics, only 5% of the working population is actually in the tech industry, which is a stunningly small number when you think about how dependent we all are. So I don't believe technology is a well-understood topic. And I'm not talking about everybody understanding how to write computer software. I'm just talking about how technology can help generate ideas for us all. And the fact that it's not well understood, I think that's wrong. I am a techie. I'm a tech business leader, if you will. But every time I've looked for a book that bridges the gap and that speaks to about technology to non-technical people, I just couldn't find one. And I looked long and hard. I wanted to share the book with my friends, with my clients, but it didn't exist. So my latest book, Trusting Technology, which was published in November by Post Hill, was written principally for non-tech leaders to help bridge that gap.
What do you think it really takes to bridge that gap?
That's a great question. Ultimately, I think it takes confidence on the part of leaders to make the right decisions, bold decisions, and confidence on the part of teams that they can make the changes, adapt to new opportunities. We can get into change management here, which is a very closely tied topic to technology. But I think the teams that do change well take advantage of the right tools, technology or not, and they've got a track record of success that gives them confidence and a boldness to move forward. I think that's what it takes.
Okay, you know, one of the things that you talk about is you've helped over like 250 businesses from startups to, you know, hey, Nike, P&G, and Disney. What have you learned from that?
For me, the technology is the easy part. I think the real challenges of using technology to greatest benefit are challenges around taking the opportunity to design or redesign the business, how the business works, how it operates, and to address the human factors. And again, this is, I think, the key opportunity for HR leaders, the human factors of where are we today, where are we going to get to, and how do we make the transition between the two. Bill Bridges wrote my favorite book on change, Managing Transition. I think it was 1993 originally. It's in its 25th edition, or 25th year edition right now. And he hits the nail on the head. I don't think it's the destination that people are scared of. It's always a blue sky destination. It's how do we get from here to there? So the human factors around making that change, finding the right tools for people. And ultimately, I think seeing technology as a platform for ideas, that to me is a real touch point for the human component of change. Too often, unfortunately, we see new technology create what I call migraine work. Somebody somewhere has to do a lot more work, a lot more keying in of information, for example, than they used to. It gets a lot harder. So we really need to alleviate migraine work and not cause it. I'll give you an example of how this popped out. You mentioned Nike there, and this is information. It's all in the public domain. We helped Nike go from traditional paper and pencil and plastic modeling process for designing shoes to a digital process. So instead of sketching out the initial shoe designs on paper, they sketched them on a tablet. And I'm talking quite a long time ago now, about 15 years ago. So this is before the iPad. This is the very early tablets. They'd sketch the image, and then they'd convert that into a 3D model. So rather than creating thousands of plastic prototypes to touch and feel and see if they've got the design right, they were able to do a lot of that work visually inside the computer. So you can imagine the time it saved, the energy it saved. But really, we were taking folks who had gone through their careers using one technique and really changing it into a whole new technique. Now, you might ask, why do that? Well, ultimately, what this did was it shaved a significant amount of time off the gap between a concept, a new shoe idea, to that shoe being in the store. And in the fashion industry, if you can take that down from 18 months to 12 months, that's a huge win. So there was a rationale for it, but nonetheless, we had to pay attention to not dampen the creativity of these brilliant footwear designers who would design 3,500 different shoe designs every season, only for that to be whittled down to maybe a dozen that actually got manufactured. So the human part was the critical success factor in that project.
You know, it's interesting. People, and there are early adopters, late adopters, kind of adopters that adopt because they have to, right? I think the workplace is certainly one of those areas where people are more inclined to do it because there's the benefit of, hey, I'm going to keep my job. And I need to get paid, and I need to make sure that I have a living, and if this is something that can make it more efficient or better, that's great. And most people want to do the right thing. But as you put in here, there is this challenge of learning. And have you found that when you look at this learning challenge from a technical side, that there's a generational component as to adaptability or adoption, or even learning how to do these things? And what are some of the techniques and processes you've looked at to try to make them more effective?
Yeah. There is a generation component, but it might not be what everybody thinks. So here's how I view it. The millennial generation, the generation that's now in the workforce, grew up with smartphones. So they grew up with a piece of technology in their hands, in their pockets, at all times. That was consumer technology, so it was designed to be easily learned. You know, try finding a training course on how to use the iPhone or on how to use Android. They just don't exist because the technology has been designed so it doesn't need to be taught. It's intuitive. what that's done really is it's raised the bar for what we'll call business systems here. So when folks go into work, if they're faced with you know, a traditional computer screen of, let's say, the 1990s, which has, you know, 500 fields of data on it, and you've got to move around and tab everywhere, that doesn't fly anymore. So I think it's raised the bar on the design of software, which in turn has impacted the human factor, because software is now more usable. Business is still catching up and probably will always be catching up on consumer technology for usability, but it is nonetheless driven by, I think, largely this generational need. And what's good for millennials is good for everybody, because if the new technology can be learned by someone, you know, of the boomer years faster because it's easier to use, then we can maybe attribute it to that. There are all other, a lot of other aspects to this question, actually. I think there might be an assumption that millennials are more comfortable with technology. I don't know that that's true. I think they're more demanding of technology.
Define that a little bit.
Well, demanding, for example, of the user experience, demanding of the fact that if something doesn't work, they've probably got less patience because they're less used to their technology failing. So I think they set higher standards in general, which in turn, the technology industry is rising to the occasion. There's a bigger role for designers now in the creation of software than there was 10, 15, 20 years ago, which I think is fantastic. Because again, a good designer means you produce good technology, which is easier to use, which means it gets used more, it gets used faster. And for the technology vendor, it means there's fewer calls to the support center. So it's a win-win all the way around.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're talking with Graham Binks. He's the author of the new book, Mastering Technology for Non-Tech Leaders, on WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back. In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobsandme.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their QuickPost product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsandME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by cmacareer.com and verrill-law.com. Today we're talking with Graham Binks. He is the author of the new book, Trusting Technology, Mastering Technology for Non-Tech Leaders. You know, I was thinking during the break, Graham, the word trust is a big word. It's a massive word. And it's really the foundation of almost everything that people do. Why is it so hard?
It's a great question. I think, you know, I'll go back to my comment a little earlier. I think that trust is hard won but easily lost, well, in every sense. If we're to have confidence in somebody or something else doing something for us, we've got our natural defense mechanisms, right? We might be a little anxious. We might be protective. We might assume it's not going to work until it proves it is. But I think it's all about proof. How does that translate, again, to technology? We have technology to do very complicated things, and it does them effectively inside a black box. So if we can't see what's going in inside that black box, we're apt to not understand it. And if we don't understand it, we're not going to trust it. How do we get over that? Well, we'll try it. We'll test it. We'll evaluate it. All kinds of different types of testing. You know, buy a new smartphone. Maybe you don't like it. You take it back to the store. Maybe it works. Right the way up to complex business systems that are handling millions of transactions a day. Very detailed test plans. But I think the proof is in the pudding. The question comes, what happens when there's a failure? How do we respond to that? If something happens a million times in a day and it only breaks once, that's a pretty high success rate. So I think it behooves us to understand how dramatic or insignificant that failure is. But ultimately, I think trust is about something working the way we expect it to work. We need to marry up our expectations with reality, and then we're likely to trust it more.
Well, you talk about in the book about how technology drives constant change. Change is the only constant, as we all know, every single day. And that is the one thing that scares the bejesus out of employees and scares the bejesus out of people in general is change. Because, in fact, I do a lot of coaching and I know it's not the change that's the problem. It's the identity of the person and what they do that becomes the problem in terms of, you know, change makes things be different. And different when I'm comfortable is hard, getting out of that ball to roll outside of the gutter, right, in terms of making that happen. How do we help employees? How does HR, business leaders, CEOs, CHRO, CFO, C-suite individuals really help employees get comfortable with the turmoil that change really creates?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple of aspects to that. I think the first aspect is to win people over by conveying clearly what the goals of the change are, what must happen, not be prescriptive, but what the outcomes must look like, and then enlisting them onto the team to contribute to that. Now contrast that with an alternative, which is to say, we are going to do this in this way by this date. To me, that does not enlist fans of the process or supporters of the process. It alienates the team members. In some cases, it might lead to sabotage. It's rare, but it happens. So I think engaging all of our people in the change decisions is priceless. And let's be honest, most of the good ideas actually don't originate in the C-suite. A lot of the good ideas originate with, you know, whoever is facing the customer, for example. So those voices need to be heard. The second part of helping here, I think, is building a track record of accomplishment, which means, in other words, having determined where we start and where we need to end, charting a path that focuses on quick wins. Any team plays better if they're confident. And any team plays better if they win the first game of the season, the second game of the season. So what are the quick wins that any major initiative, however large it may be, can actually knock off early on? And then build up momentum, gradually take on bigger and bigger challenges. Understand what the plan is, but also understand that a plan never works out perfectly. Reality bites the minute the work starts. So understand that things need to be learned. Plan that learning during the project early on, and just build up a confidence in accomplishment and adaptability on the team's part. I think those two key elements is what makes for winning teams, and that's what makes for winning businesses.
We're talking with Graham Banks. He's the author of the new book, Trusting Technology, Mastering Technology for Non-Tech Leaders. You know, we've talked a little bit about change, right? We've talked a little bit about how technology can drive that change. You also talk about in the book the complexity as the enemy of progress. Elaborate.
So most businesses evolve over time, which is of necessity. To get a business started, to get it bootstrapped, and to grow it, it's important to be responsive to what the customer needs. However, if that process continues, let's say, relatively unchecked, it's a growth through reactivity. Business operations will evolve without reflection on the bigger picture. So intricate processes and exceptions often arise from that. And when everything is hands-on, when the business is small, intricacy is easy. Everybody can do things differently. But intricacy doesn't scale. So when a business hits a certain point, those challenges start to really hold back the growth of the business. And it can end up like the metaphorical pile of spaghetti. It inhibits adaptability. So to me, complexity arises out of that process. Big change initiatives, often technology-driven, but they don't have to be, they provide an opportunity to do a reset. They provide an opportunity to step back and ask questions around, why have we always done it this way? If that was the right way to do it 5 years ago, is it the right way to do it 5 years from now? It's an opportunity to rethink those things, and which I like to refer to as the design of business. So if we put in a piece of technology to do things the way we've always done it, we'll stay in the past. But if we take those opportunities to rethink how we should do it, how other people are doing it, and what it should look like in 5 years' time, and then bring in technology to make that happen, that's where we get the big wins. So it's important we don't build complexity or legacy complexity into the future. Otherwise, it stymies our progress.
Well, you know, I want to switch gears for a few minutes and talk a little bit about you. I mean, look, the audience doesn't know you. You have a little bit of a British accent there, but I know you're actually living in Toronto, so... And where's the connection there?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I grew up in the UK. I came to Canada many years ago. I was presented with a work opportunity, which I decided to take. I planned to come over here for 2 years, and that was almost 28 years ago. So never make long-term plans is my mantra. I met a Canadian. I fell in love. My family is Canadian now. So I stayed here. I still get back to the UK very often. Got a lot of friends. Got family over there. It doesn't quite make me bilingual, but it does give me probably a mid-Atlantic accent. So wherever I go, apparently, I have an accent.
Well, let me see. So let's see. That would mean you like fish and chips and then anything with what? A? I'm just
maybe.
Maybe. Okay. Just asking questions. A little humor out there. Well, that's good. And so tell us a little bit about, you know, when you're looking at, you know, when you were thinking about the book, What brought you to write it? I know you've written other books. Tell us a little about your book history. What got you to write books? Tell us a little about the history on that.
Yeah, well, my jumping off point really was the realization I referred to a little earlier that there's a gap in the book market. I don't know the exact number, but I believe there's a million books published every year. I've heard somebody say that. But when it came to the area that I work in, which is the juncture of business and technology, the market is very bifurcated. There's a lot of great visionary technology books around business, Good to Great. Jim Collins is a prime example. There's lots of books about Big Five or Six Vendors. It's a great book. There's lots of deep technical tomes, I'll call them. These books are 2 inches thick. If you want to get deep into a technology, you get one of those books and you'll learn it. The O'Reilly books are an example of that. There was nothing between. So, I kind of had an aha one day when I realized this. And I thought, well, that's wrong. That's a gap. There needs to be something in between. So I decided to write the book. Now, in my work, I've had the honor to help many businesses and to impact a lot of different industries. I've worked in mental health and public safety and fashion, transportation, banking, insurance, industrial design, and even, believe it or not, laundry, and have an impact on how businesses in those industries operate. And of course, I've made a lot of mistakes in doing that. And to this day, you know, my urge is always to find something new. I work with new clients all the time, and I'm still learning with every new initiative, every new industry I walk into. It's great to be able to bring something that I learned in laundry, for example, and apply it to a customer in insurance. You might not believe that could happen, but believe me, it does. So having made those mistakes, having learned, I believe that's how we learn. I thought the book gave me a great opportunity to share what I've learned in a positive way. And, you know, there's some of don't do it like this in the book. I've got some examples of how not to do things in there, but I do keep the names of the businesses anonymous, obviously, to protect. And then I've got ideas about how, you know, that could be done better or how we have done that better. And that's really what I wanted to convey through the book in a way that's hopefully entertaining. Hopefully it's an interesting read. I don't know if it's a page turner, but you know, if anyone gets to the last chapter, I feel a sense of pride, and I've had some good feedback so far.
No, it's absolutely, you know, you might, these are the type of conversations people have, when they're talking about their phone, when they're talking about, I mean, technology is what people talk about. What type of conversation starters, when people ask you about technology really are out there? I mean, it's a good jump off point for you, is it not?
Yeah, it is. People tend to start conversations about technology, I think, in one or two ways, perhaps polar opposites. The first way is, I'm having problems. Something isn't working. You know, my technology is failing. It's bringing my business to a halt. It's slowing us down. Or, you know, let's hope this never happens. I've had a security breach, whatever, you know. The topic is, this is broken, it shouldn't be that way, help me understand how I can fix it. On the other end of the scale, it's I'm really intrigued by the potential that technology could have for my business, for my strategy. You know, if I had a better understanding of what other people and other industries had done, maybe I could apply that and really change the trajectory of my business. What I like to do in those conversations is, it's the second type that really excites me, but if someone comes to me for help, I'm not going to turn them away. I say, we can figure this out. We can solve that problem, but I want you to promise me when we solve that problem, you won't stop there. You will go to the opportunity end of the scale. So if we can get people out of the challenges they're in and start thinking again about the future and the intriguing potential that technology could have for their business, I think that's a win-win.
It absolutely is, and this is one of those conversations that is critical for business and HR professionals to understand. Hey, you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. We'll be right back with more Graham Banks. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello. I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs and ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
The best paints for the job site are at the Home Depot, specifically new Glidden Diamond Paint and Primer. It starts at only $23.98 a gallon. It's specially formulated to spray easier and cover walls faster. A lot faster. So you're done and on to the next job faster. Better paint means better jobs. New Glidden Diamond Paint and Primer starting at just $23.98 a gallon. You'll only find it in one place. The Home Depot. More saving. More do it. U.S. only.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. Today we're talking with Graham Banks. He's the author of Trusting Technology, Mastering Technology for Non-Tech Leaders. I'm your host, David Chulo, and today we're having a good conversation. You know what? It's interesting, Graham. You mentioned in the last segment towards the end where I was going for the start of this segment, which is cybersecurity. And ironically, it's only about a page in your book about it. You better explain that.
You bet, yeah. I've had a lot of conversations with business leaders, with technologists about security, and the fundamental challenge I see there is a big gap. If a non-technical person or a leader asks for an explanation of security, you can go one of two ways. You can dive right into the details, go real deep, take 20 minutes to explain a simple concept and lose their attention in 2 minutes. Or you can give them a one-pager that they can read in 2 minutes and know what they need to know. No more, no less. If they want to understand more, they can drill down later. So I set it as a goal that I would encapsulate on a single page everything a business leader of all stripes needs to know about security, and certainly what they need to know first. So it's deliberate. The context of that page, I will say, is in the chapter I wrote about information and how it's handled. Security is an element of that. It's a challenging element. Unfortunately, I think it's held us back in a number of areas. The concern about sharing data because of security issues or because of the news we read or hear about security leaks, it's curtailing the potential value in a number of industries. The biggest one that comes to mind, I think, is healthcare. But we'll get past that. We'll overcome it. And it's at that point, I think, that the rocket ship really can be launched on what artificial intelligence and big data can do in those industries.
I think that, though, that is at the crust of the word trust. Cybersecurity and its challenges, for lack of a better word, is partially at the core of employees worrying about their information and about companies worrying about breaches and about information in email and texts. And it certainly doesn't help that if you think about it, it has become a political conversation as much as it is a factual conversation about, protecting one's data and giving out information, and you can't share certain things. You know, how do you look in the future and say, okay, 2 or 3 years from now, as you said, we're going to get past it, when, in fact, I see it getting even tighter, really, from regulators and individuals really questioning that trust with data?
Yeah. I think there's two elements to the answer to that question. I think the first element is the definition of privacy has changed and has changed forever. Because we're taking advantage of technology like Google and like Facebook to do things we couldn't do 15, 20 years ago, that might be considered a win. Unfortunately, it has shifted the goalposts on what it means to be private. The one way to guarantee your information will be private is unplug your computer from the network or don't put it on your computer at all. It's that simple. I think generationally, again, we'll go back to the millennials, I think they feel that more than those of us that are more used to high levels of privacy. So that's on the one side. On the other side, I think the combination of technology and you know, potentially some of the regulations, particularly GDPR coming in Europe, it's starting to set precedents in the United States, is going to give people more comfort that they own their own data. There are interesting things happening around a technology that everyone's heard of called blockchain. It's associated with cryptocurrency, but it's actually a whole lot more than that. And for the purposes here, it doesn't matter, but it's an example of a technology that I think can give people better control over who sees their data and who doesn't. It's a political issue, it's a societal issue, but I think our expectations are shifting towards less privacy at the same time that technology is going to enable us to achieve those levels of privacy.
What do you feel will be the catalyst? I mean, you're in the field, you talk to mm-hmm. people in this area. What is going to be the catalyst to make that change? Because I believe there's got to be something that's going to get people to rally around that type of change you're talking about.
Yeah. I would argue the shift has begun. Is there something dramatic in the near future that could change it? I mean, there's the potential for dramatically bad things to happen, but there's been a lot of press lately around how social media data has been used, and I would actually say that the population has been resilient in spite of that information. So I'm not sure if there's a major negative that will set us back. I think there's a realization. I'll give you an example, and I'll make it very clear. I'm not a medical expert, but as we do all have experience of healthcare, when you think about the potential for artificial intelligence to help doctors do their jobs better, be more productive, narrow down the diagnoses, not specifically hit on a diagnosis, but help the doctor make a diagnosis in 10 minutes rather than an hour. And you connect that to the fact that data exists that could be gathered to help that process. I think maybe one day we'll wake up and we'll say, hey, we should put the focus on taking advantage of that, and we'll take the risks inherent in sharing data. Something like that, I think. Now, whether that's going to be a big news piece that comes out on CNN or New York Times and changes the world, maybe, maybe not. But I think there'll be a gradual shift in that direction.
As you know today, obviously, hiring is a challenge as we talk about the skills gap and a shortage of technology skills out there. How can leaders address this? And do you talk about that in your book?
Yeah. There's been press around the shortage of technology skills. There was one particularly, and I think it's unfortunate, but there was one particularly an often quoted report that came out about a year ago, maybe 15 months ago, that said there's only 10,000 people in the world with the necessary skills to build the next generation of artificial intelligence. I kind of think that's an irresponsible comment. It's clearly not true. There are other reports that point to it. But I think the shortage of technology skills is a little overestimated. But nonetheless, precious skills are in demand. It's hard to hire great people. One of the things I've seen work really well, though, here is to kind of raise the average skill, if you will, of an organization rather than focus on the leaders. So you're creating expertise by merging skills. James Dyson, the vacuum guru, specifically hires engineers and he trains them in design. So he ends up with a kind of a unique hybrid. I think if we look at combinations of skills, we'll build a team that can take on greater challenges that are technology enabled. So we'll have techies who have maybe stronger communication and business skills, and we'll have non-techies who will appreciate the potential of technology, the challenges of technology. And I think together, those folks can, if you will, raise the technology IQ of a business. So I'm a big believer that expertise can be created through various means, you know, mixing teams, different skills, multidisciplinary, good coaching, making sure that every team has at least one person on the team that's done this before, whether that's an internal person or it's an external help. And I think really it comes back to the basic premise of my book, which is that technology is a platform for everyone's ideas. The more we understand about the platform, the more likely we are to come up with ideas that we can actually achieve.
We're talking with Graham Binks. He is the author of Trusting Technology, Mastering Technology Through Non-Tech Leaders. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we'll be right back. In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employee relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobsandme.com has been matching main employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their QuickPost product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsandME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com and verrill-law.com. Today we're talking with Graham Binks. He's the author of Trusting Technology, Mastering Technology for Non-Tech Leaders. You know, I think we've had a really good discussion today, and as we look here at the end of the show, I'm always left with what is that last final question that can encapsulate what exactly you're trying to get across. So I'll do it this way. Where do HR leaders go from here? Where do CEOs and C-suite leaders go from here? How do they get started? I know, obviously, they get your book. That's pretty obvious. But where do they get started? And what do they need to take away from today's show to make a difference?
Yeah. I think the opportunity for the HR leader, and probably unique within the organization, well, HR leaders are sort of pivotal. I mean, they're involved in every part of the company. So they have a view that typically is not shared with anyone other than the CEO in terms of the span. I think the advice I would give and where I've seen HR make a real impact here is firstly to champion the human factors of any change. And this applies whether or not it's technology-driven, technology-enabled. A lot of change is, most perhaps, but it doesn't have to be. So, you know, consider the impact we've talked about here of the change and the transition. Consider whether the new tools, the destination, really is a fit that's going to, as I said earlier, reduce migraine work for the user base in the organization. So championing the human side of projects is historically has not been a strength of IT. They champion the technical side, so I think HR can balance that off. The second area here, and again, just as the first one applied to technology and beyond, I think this can too. I think talent strategies that emphasize the cross-fertilization of expertise between different disciplines, in this case tech and non-tech, that they can really help the whole team become more tech literate, if you will, and become more resilient in the face of technology change and more championing of it, see more opportunities. And that's a massive return, I think, for any business. And the third piece is, it's kind of a suggestion I make to anyone, whatever their role is. I believe technology does two things, and two things only. It can help us generate insights and make better decisions, and it can enable us to take action on those decisions in a fast and efficient manner by essentially bottling the expertise in the organization. Generating insights to me is about how we use data and information. If data and information is static and it's not being consumed, it's a waste of space. It's only valuable when it helps trigger light bulbs and create insights and ideas. And we have expertise, and expertise delivered by people is a great thing. If we can build tools and software to help those people be more efficient, and I used the example earlier of helping a doctor make a diagnosis faster with AI, that's the second piece. So my advice here is anytime a change initiative relating to technology hits the table, apply that test. How is this going to generate more insights inside or outside our organization for our customers? And how is it going to enable faster, more efficient action on the decisions that follow? And if you can't check at least one of those boxes, it probably isn't worth doing.
Graham, where can somebody get your book?
Amazon and Barnes & Noble. My website is grahambinks.com, and there's a link there to both a summary of the book and directly to Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Well, of course, I even have a better idea, is they can go to hrpowerhour.com right after this show, and they can link directly to you and your book. Right? And
that's
so any way is fine. I'm just making a suggestion.
Yes.
But in this
Absolutely.
Particular case, they can go there, they can see a little short bio on you, and obviously they will have a picture of the book there as well. Graham, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I appreciate you sharing with us about your new book. I think it's a very critical topic, and I think it's one of those topics that's only going to get more important as the years pass.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk, WLOB 100.5 FM. And we'll be right back with the HR Tip of the Week. And now, your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Hi, I'm Richard Moon from Verrill. This week's Tip of the Week is, don't panic when you start to reopen your business. But do have a detailed plan. This will require such things as deciding, is somebody going to be responsible for monitoring the plan? Who will be responsible for safety, such as worker layout, making sure all the supplies that you need are there? Who's going to evaluate whether there are job changes so that you're able to decide who to recall first? Will there be pay changes if there are job changes? There needs to be a plan that you can explain to your employees and, if necessary, explain to a third party who may challenge it on the basis of discrimination or other statutes that protect worker rights.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.